Jeffrey Layton from Red Hat will be talking about getting the most out of the Linux SIFS client.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jeff Layton, and you've seen the title anyway. So here's the things I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to do an overview of what Linux SIFS is, talk about the SMB version selection, authentication, cache coherency, locking coherency, read and write performance, access control, and identity mapping. So without further ado, so what is Linux SIFS? Well, it's the in-kernel file system that speaks SMB. I mean, Steve outlined a lot of this, but basically this is, there was an older one that Volker actually wrote quite some time ago, but that was called SMBFS, and this file system superseded it in the kernel. It's a Samba-affiliated project, but we're not really officially part of Samba. We ship in a different tarball and in the Linux kernel, obviously. So we have two main pieces. There's the kernel file system. I often call it sifs.ko because that's the kernel module. And that has most of the code. It's distributed as part of the Linux kernel. And there's also sysutils, which is a small package of user space utilities for handling things like it's a mount helper, some upcall programs, and things like that for doing Kerberos and ID mapping, that sort of thing. So anyway, mounting a typical SIFS file system, this is how you do it from the command line. Pretty obvious. I'm going to assume that most people know how to do this sort of thing. SIFS.ko supports a lot of options. Some of them are poorly understood, poorly documented. So I'll talk about some of those today. One of our goals is to strive for sensible defaults, but as often is the case when we're dealing with Windows and the radically different semantics there, it's not always possible to get sensible defaults. So first I'll talk about SMB version selection. Now we have multiple versions, right? So we have 2.1 and 3.0 support, as Steve pointed out in his last talk. By default, we speak SMB1. And as of kernel 3.5, we can also support SMB2, 2.1. There's some nominal support for 2.002 and 3.0. But the implementations are not quite as robust. 3.0 is basically just 2.1 with the, with the version bumped or whatever, and none of the optional flags turned on. 2.02, I'm not quite sure about how well it is fleshed out. You use the verse equals option mount option to select which version you want, and currently we don't have a whole lot of advantage to using versions that are higher than 1.0. It's still pretty toy-like at the moment. We need 2x needs some support for multi-credit requests and compounds, as Steve was talking about in his talk.
3.7 is the realistic minimum.
Right. Sorry. Let me go back. Yeah, we allowed you to mount with 2.1 in version 3.5, but the support was not quite there. And honestly, as always, we want you to run the latest because that's where we fixed all the bugs. That we know of. The next thing I'll talk about is authentication. So when you mount a SIFS server, you need to, and it's an authenticated protocol, so you have to decide what sort of authentication you're going to do on the wire. Traditionally, we always did simple NTLM v1 authentication, which was the default in pre-3.7. In 3.7, we switched to NTLM SSP is the default, which is NTLM v2 encapsulated in a raw NTLM SSP frame. We also can support NTLM v2, which is an unencapsulated NTLM v2, but that's not well supported by a lot of servers. You can specify sec equals none for anonymous auth, KRB5 for Kerberos. Kerberos authentication requires an upcall. And you can specify I for an integrity, which is turns on signing. So I'll talk about Kerberos here in a bit. But anyway, as I mentioned, Kerberos requires an upcall, and here's a little diagram that shows how it works. Basically, we do an upcall. When you're talking mount.sifs, we'll do an upcall, or we'll call into sifs to do the mount. Mount will figure out that it needs a Kerberos ticket. It reaches down into the keys API, which then calls out to user space to do a request key to a program called request key, or to do a request key call, and then that actually calls out to sifs upcall, which does the which goes and fetches the key out of the correct CRED cache and hands it back down to the kernel. We're also talking with I've been talking with Simo about overhauling this. He's got a new daemon that he's just got merged into the kernel for NFSD to talk to this daemon called GSS proxy that he's written that does this a little bit more sanely. The code that did all this is pretty rickety. So we're looking at maybe overhauling this and changing how it all works in the not too distant future. The user level stuff should all pretty much be the same. You'll just mount with KRB5. It's just how we go and fetch the key out of the users, out of the CRED cache will be a little different. So anyway, mounting with Kerberos is a little poorly understood. So we get a lot of questions about this on the mailing list. So we have to separate sort of the idea that when you mount with Kerberos, we have a set of credentials we use for mounting, and then we have another set of credentials we use for general user access. In some cases, those are the same. Some cases, they're not. So the ticket used to handle the SMBs generated by the mount syscall is the mount credentials, right? So whenever you call a mount syscall, then it tells the kernel to mount up this file system. That's handled by the credentials that we end up fetching from user space for that is the mount credentials. When you mount, you can pass in a -o CRUID mount option. In really old kernels, we also did that. It used the UID option to decide what CRED cache to fetch the credentials out of. These creds are always associated with a root user. So even after a mount time, root will always use the same creds as whatever was used to do the mount. And a single user mount, which is the default. All SMBs use these credentials regardless of who is accessing the mount. So if you mount, a single user mount will always use the same credentials, period. And the same is the case with Kerberos. And a multi-user mount, only root will use these credentials. And then whenever another user walks into that mount point or does some operation under there, we will transparently create a new session for that mount user or for that user, and he will access with his own creds. So I'll talk a little bit about that later. It's also possible to use a key tab for mounting. In fact, I recommend it. If you've got it set up in etcfs tab or something like that, using a key tab allows you to do it without having to hide passwords anywhere. And you can also use the -o username to tell it what principal name to use. The username gets turned into the principal name for KRB5 auth. So now let me switch gears and we'll talk a little bit about cache coherency. You've got your sys file system mounted, now what, right? So you go and traditionally the sys code used a very loose caching model and was very NFS-like. And obviously that was a horrible protocol violation, right? The sys protocol has traditionally said, if you don't hold an op lock, you do not cache, right? You're supposed to write through to the server directly or read from the server directly for everything. So you can get that. We also have another option. And so you can still get that behavior by just specifying cache equals loose. Cache equals, in pre-3.5 kernel, or in 3.5 kernels, we switched to, we added a, or in early, I can't remember exactly which version we did it, but we added a strict, Pavel added a strict cache option that allowed, that caused sifs to adhere to the SIFS protocol more strictly. So right now, now when strict is enabled, which is what I recommend and what's the default now, then you only cache when an op-lock is held. And what happens is we cache data into the page cache when we hold an op-lock. When that op-lock is revoked, we dump the page cache or, you know, flush it or whatever, and then we start doing I/O almost like O direct to the server. And none is essentially the same case. It's just that we don't request op-locks. Sure.
This is per mount, as in all access to server colon share.
It's per super block, yes, so per mount. Yes. Yep. Yes, it's not per file or anything that granular.
Per user session.
No. It's nothing like that. So the default in 3.7 plus is strict. In older kernels, it was loose. So I really, you know, if you're running an older kernel and you've got support for a strict cache, it's good to turn it on because it's we get a lot of reports occasionally where people are saying, well, you know, I'm accessing files from multiple machines and I'm getting weird data corruption. This, you know, the idea is that this would take care of that.
Well, strict would take care of it too.
Strict would take care of it. Well, if in earlier kernels, we had we called it strict cache. There was no cache equals option. I added a cache equals option to make it clear that some of these options were mutually exclusive. They were not, it was not at all clear before, so you'd get people that would try to say, I want to force direct IO, but also do strict cache, and you know, it was very muddled. So I tried to clean this up a little bit to make it clearer that some of those are mutually exclusive. Moving on to FS cache. So FS cache allows you to cache data to disk. So the idea is that it's sort of like a swap for page cache. The NFS uses it to deal with the case where you may have a server that, like a bunch of clients that reboot, and when they come up, they all come up, they try to fetch their data from the server, and the server gets hammered, right? So the idea of FS cache is that you can cache some large data files that and then have it fetch it out of its local disk cache after a reboot. Obviously, that's kind of fundamentally at odds with how the cache, or how the SIFS cache coherency protocol model, or how the SIFS cache coherency model works, right? So you only get that behavior if you use cache equals loose. If you use cache equals strict, you'll still get the ability to use FS cache, but I think it only really comes into play if you're using memory pressure. We've not done a lot of testing with this either. This was put in a while back by Suresh. I can't pronounce his last name. Jarayaman. He was at SUSE, but he did some good work on it. But I've never really played with it very much. Exactly, yes. Yeah. And a lot of that was driven, actually, the FS cache merge was driven by Dave Howells did all the work, but who really wanted it was the film studios. Right. So a lot of them wanted to be able to deal with these giant files, and they would slurp them down from the NFS server whenever they boot up, and it would just kill them. So.
The prequel solves the same problem, right?
The what now? I'm sorry.
Yes.
I wasn't in his talk, but yes, I think the branch cache I think I know what you're talking about. So anyway, after you cache coherency, we have to deal with byte range locking coherency. So, you know, obviously you can do POSIX byte range locks on POSIX file systems. Windows does not understand them. So what we do currently is map POSIX byte range lock requests onto Windows lock requests. And obviously that causes all sorts of havoc because they don't actually merge very well semantically. POSIX locks, Windows locks are mandatory. So if you set a lock on a file, it will block you from possibly reading or writing that file, maybe even deleting, things like that. POSIX locks are advisory. The only thing that blocks is other lock requests. With a POSIX byte range lock, they split and merge. So if you lock a big range and unlock a couple bytes in the middle, you get two locks that are, you know, around there. Windows locks don't really do that. They stack. You have to unlock them as you lock them. So occasionally we'll get cases on the list where people have mounted the same share with Linux and Windows, and they're trying to edit open office documents in particular. And that is a very problematic thing, turns out to be very problematic because they use a different locking model in the Windows and Linux version of their app. So this is probably something we ought to bring up with them at some point and figure out how we reconcile this, but right now there's no. So it's best to really just avoid applications that do a lot of locking on SIFS code, especially if you want any sort of coherency with Windows clients. Right, you can disable, you can mount with, I should probably put that on the slide, but you can mount with -o no lock, I think, and that will make all your locking local. But that's not generally what people expect when they do locking on a, you know, they expect to exclude other users of the thing, no matter even if they're on a different client. But yes, it is possible to bypass that. So now let's talk about read and write performance. So as Steve mentioned before, we did a lot of work over the last couple of years to really fix up read and write performance in SIFS code. And it's a lot faster now than it used to be. So we added 3.0, we added support for async writes for cached requests. So if you're doing, if you're caching in or you're doing caching into the page cache, whenever you get whenever you go to do a write, we now do a much larger. We'll do a much larger write out of the page cache if possible, and we also will do issue them in parallel. So cached I/O out of the page cache is always page aligned, though, which can be a little hairy when you've got byte range locks. So in any case, that's what. In 3.0, that support went in. In 3.4, we added support for uncached requests. So, like, if you do not have a op lock and you're doing strict caching, then in 3.4, you still get async I/O. It's just that when you go to issue that write, rather than it going into the page cache and being flushed out later, we issue it directly to the server right then. And they're also done, they're not necessarily page aligned at that point. The maximum WSI, the write size that we issue on the wire, is much larger in 3.0 plus. There's a little chart down here which shows you the default and the max that we use. We use the pick the defaults to match what Windows does. Without POSIX extensions, then we use 64K by default because that's what Windows issues. But what we found is that there are some SMB1 servers that, oddly enough, are engineered only for Windows clients. So, so we find that if we default to what Windows does, then things work by default. You can bump the maximum up to larger sizes, though. And same when you're doing it POSIX. If you're dealing with Samba in particular, it does POSIX extensions. We can do much larger writes. We default to 1 meg writes on the wire, and you can bump that even up to 16 meg if you are brave. Right now, SMB2 is capped at 64K, primarily because we don't have any support for multi-credit requests yet. That's one of the things I mentioned earlier. Similarly, for reads, we added initial support for async and larger reads in 3.2. That also does page-aligned IOs if you are if you have an op lock or if you're doing are going through the page cache with cache equals loose. 3.5 has support for uncached reads, but on a 32-bit arch, you really want 3.7. I think I even talked to Tom about this last summer when I was at the Microsoft Redmond event. We had the initial support for all this stuff really abused the kernel's address space. And so it would map in a bunch of pages all at once and then try to do IOs to them. And on 32-bit arch, that address space is limited, so we had to do some hacks to work around that for a bit. But that's all now been fixed now in 3.7. So you really want to be doing 3.7 for all this stuff if you can. Again, SMB2 is capped at 64K because of lack of multi-credit support. No, you know, that's correct. I think that is what Windows does for default reads on SMB1.
We found pretty good data going up to reading rights was about 120K, and then there was one server that 120K failed.
There were several. I think there were at least a couple that where we got reports, and at that point I looked closely at what Windows did on the wire, and it was like 60K.
There are a couple of off by a page issues.
Right.
Otherwise, evenly sized block.
Correct, and I think that's what it does that for that. But it requests 60K writes, as far as I could tell, on the wire, and at least on current versions.
So. Most servers we did find they supported over 64K.
Right. Yeah. And again, this is just the defaults. You can bump it up to the maximum. In fact, you can go to the max on Windows, against Windows. I mean, if you're running a Windows servers, deal with that just fine. It's really a lot of these third-party servers. So, if you can, try it. And if it works, great. But if not, you get to keep both pieces, right? So. Yes, correct. So a brief note about socket options. Occasionally we get people asking about socket options can we do stuff to tune the socket, behavior? Not a lot, really. You can select a different port. By default, we use 445, of course, and I think we fall back to 139 for really old servers if it doesn't respond on 445. But you want to avoid 139 if you can, because it does a little bit of net BIOS encapsulation, and that adds a slight bit of overhead. There's an undocumented, we had an undocumented sock opt equals option in there that was the only option that took was TCP no delay. We did some testing and never could prove that it actually helped anything. And nowadays, as part of that fix to the address space, we now cork and uncork the socket, which is in Linux, what you can do is you can cork a socket, and when you know that you're going to be issuing a lot of writes to that socket in succession. And then we uncork it whenever we're done with our send. So now we send, most of our sends go across the wire pretty much atomically, one frame at a time, one SMB frame at a time. POSIX extensions, again, allow the tunneling lets you sort of tunnel POSIX semantics across the protocol. Steve was talking about some of these earlier. We need to add these for SMB2 as well. But for now, it's mostly larger read write sizes. Ownership permissions, opens and creates for POSIX and make dir, POSIX locks, that kind of stuff. We enable them by default if the server supports them, but in some cases it is advantageous to turn them off with dash o no Unix. A lot of times when I'm testing something, and I need to have a POSIX extensions off, I'll turn it off with that. But in most cases, you want to leave it on if you can. Okay, now we get the really nasty part, which is ownership and permissions. This is where SIFS gets really difficult, or it's confusing. So when we deal with ownership and permissions, we have to deal with two different pieces, really. We have the display of them, which really discerns, involves the result of stat calls, anything where you're doing stat or fstat, that kind of stuff. And then we have enforcement, which is permissions checking, right? So in summary, which I'll give first, a client will displays permissions according to what it knows, right? So it seems obvious, but that is how it works. And it will sometimes enforce those permissions, which seems sort of goofy, but it does. But again, and then also permissions, regardless though, are always enforced on the server according to the credentials you use. So if you mount, or whatever credentials the SMB call carries, that is what the server is going to enforce permissions based on those credentials, no matter what.
I think that's a very important qualifier, that it's not the credentials of the user logged on, for example.
Exactly. Well, not necessarily, right? So, and I'll get to that in a moment. So we'll talk about display first, right? So with POSIX extensions, we had the ability to get UID, GID ownership from the server. And we also can get mode bits. So that allows us to really present a reasonable display in like an LS-L type thing. The problems that you find, though, is the model here is very NFSv3-like. So if you, we sort of assume that that UIDs and GIDs are unity mapped on the client and server. So if you have them mapped differently, a lot of times that won't make any sense. You'll see nonsensical owners and groups. Without POSIX extensions, the UIG and GID are set to the default owner on the mount. The mode is set to the file mode or the dir mode mount options, which are mount options you can pass in to tell it what you want the modes to look like. We also have this other beast called SysACL. So when you're updating inode info, so like we go to do a stat or to go to fetch information for an inode, it opens the file, reads the ACL off of that file, tries to map it into mode bits, then it maps the SIDs to UIGs and DIDs with an upcall, and then it closes the file. So it uses the SIFSIDMAP program in there to translate. And I did a bunch of work actually about 6 months ago to make this actually work properly. But the problem is that you can't really do a good mapping of the ACL from mode bits. And even worse, if you go chmod the file later, it tends to clobber your ACL and write its own new one in there, which is sort of not so good. And this is also terrible for performance because opening a file, obviously, you end up breaking op locks. So if you go to do like an ls-l in a directory, anybody that's got a file open in that directory is going to lose their op lock at that point. So it's really not such a good thing to use. I do not really recommend using it if you can get away with it. So back to talking about permissions enforcement. So historically, we always sys mounts were always single user, right? And so that meant that everybody who accessed this mount was sharing credentials to the server. So root did calls to the server with a particular credentials, and whoever happened to wander into this thing also did the same thing. So that's not so good, right? Because the server has no way to tell who's actually doing this or do any sort of same permissions enforcement. So what was done in those days traditionally was to try to map, or you would use the local inode permissions to exclude certain people from the mount. So you would say, if you mounted this thing up as root, you might say that this mount is only accessible by a particular user, and you do that by setting the file mode, dir mode, use UID, GID on the mount. There are better ways to do this now where we actually send the correct credentials. And those are our multi-user mounts. So I added the support for this about, 2 or 3 years ago. And this is actually a very nice thing, and I tend to recommend people do this if they can. But what it does is it allows you to mount up a share with a particular set of root credentials. And we can talk a little bit about how the best ways to do that in a bit. And then whenever another user wanders into the share or wanders into the mount, we look and see whether we've already got a session set up for them. If not, then we go fetch credentials for them in different ways and talk to the server and just set up a session to the server to do all their accesses. So we do. And then if they wander out of the share and don't come back after a period of inactivity, we tear down that session. So currently with this, we only supported it with Kerberos. And now we have a way to do it with username password type authentication as well. But you need, for KRV5, you need an upcall. And for username password authentication, the user has to store his credentials in his key ring. And so the key ring then is the stash in the kernel that that is not fetchable from user space. So a way to you can go and stick these credentials in there, and then whenever the kernel needs to go and establish a new session, he's got access to he can just go grab them out of the special spot in the key ring. So again, with sec equals caret b5, once the mount is, once that user walks in there, he needs a valid cred cache. If you don't have one, you'll get access denied when you walk in. And with password-based auth methods, we have to use the syscreds program to stuff them in there. So there's a program in sysutils called syscreds that will manage the cache. No. Probably we really ought to add a PAM module.
Yeah. So what I'm thinking is if we had such a PAM, if we could detect some of these stuff and stuff in the key ring, we ought to make sure the call for SMB2.
That would be nice, yeah. We'll talk about that.
We have to detect that the key ring is populated.
Well, that's easy, but we can do that.
Because I think that this makes life a lot easier. Yeah.
Another key point is that when you do this, client-side permissions enforcement is disabled. The reason being, obviously, if you've got the server governing or enforcing permissions for you, there's really not a whole lot of reason to have the client do that for you as well. So without POSIX extensions or SysACL or any other way of seeing what the mode bits are, and if you're accessing a standard SIF share, ownership is displayed as if it were owned by you. So, which is a little odd. So, when two different people looking in this directory will see different ownership, but they will, but that won't affect how you access the file or whether your permission checks works. So, there's a few amount options you can use to work with SIFs. There's the UID, GID, file mode. I've already fairly well documented in the man page. We also got force UID, force GID, which can make the kernel or the client disregard the ownership presented by the server. In a few cases, people have requested to be able to do this, but it's pretty rare.
Well, the ownership on the server doesn't match the different.
Right.
Yeah. Which is common, right? You have the server
UID
don't match the client UID.
In some cases. And then you can disable client-side permission checking entirely with no perm, and of course, no perm is implied with the multi-user mount option as well.
What's the difference between those?
Multi-user gives you that multi-user ability. No perm just says, I'm not going to do any client-side permissions enforcement, but I'm still going to share the credentials on the mount. Right, so. Backup intent. This was added about 6 months ago or so. Shirish did a patch to add the ability to do to handle backup intent, and so a program. So whenever you do backup intent on the wire, you have to basically Windows gives you a way to allow backup programs to access a file system with special permissions, and so this program must be able to open files. It has to have a special, I guess, permission flag or something in its account. And it has to be able to open the files with these extra flags. So you need, what we settled on to be able to manage this is that we set this on a per credential basis. So the idea being that most backup programs run as a particular user, a lot of times root. And then so you can set the backup UID, backup GID to enable these flags to be on when these calls go out on the wire. I don't believe it does that. I think the implicit idea is that you are mounting as a user, or you're accessing this share as a user that has this backup, special backup flag in its credentials, and then we set these in certain types of calls. So these two flags. So I can create, and when we open a file, we'll create it, or we'll do a create and x. We open it with the backup intent flag, and when we do a lookup or a redir, we set these backup search flags.
That's on the Linux end.
On the Linux end, right.
What does it do to the actual information at the fast
It gives you extra permissions to see things. At least that's my understanding.
Imagine the open with flag clues the server to look to see if your user has this capability.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So moving on more with permissions. As I said, I mean the server always governs always enforce permissions, but we have a way to be able to see them and set them now. There's a set of xadders that we can access the files with, and we have a couple tools in sysutils that allow you to get to them. We're anxiously awaiting someone to pick up the rich ACL work and run with that, and so that we can not have to use special tools for this sort of thing. And so if you mount with -o sysACL, you can also change ACLs via mode bit translation. But again, I don't really recommend that because of its downsides. Identity mapping. So we also have the ability now to do SID to UID, GID translation in SIFS. Primarily, it's in get sysACL, set sysACL. So when you are fetching ACL info, you can now see the names in the ACL list, and you can also set ACLs using names instead of having to hand in or do the hand translation of SIDs. The original implementation used WinBind to do the mapping, but we had some requests from SIMO and a couple other folks to turn it into a plugin interface. So now there's a SSSD program in the works, plugin in the works. SSSD is sort of I don't know how to describe it really, but it's a module that handles authentication management on the client, I guess is the best way to say it. Probably someone else could describe it better. Mm-hmm.
Have you started looking at all of the dynamic access control that came?
No, I have not yet, so yeah. It would be nice to have, though. That's
backup and migration is a big deal, right? Because some of these little tiny appliances.
Yeah, from the client, I mean, I think we're trying to get away from doing any sort of enforcement on the client, right? But being able to set and query those access controls would be very nice to have. So that's probably something we should add in the future.
One best way to access that.
Sure. Yes. You can back the data that it fetches, that you fetch out of the xadder, is just the raw ACL byte stream, basically.
Right.
And for backups, that's really what sort of the intended purpose of that was. But you also have the ability to use this tool to manage them as well, or the tools to manage them. I did promise to talk about some use cases, so here's one. A really common usage pattern we have for SIFS is that people want to do home directory type access. Not necessarily Linux home directories, but they want to be able to allow people to get into their SIFS home dir from a Linux box. And so this is typically the way I recommend that people set this up. You just set up some credentials that you want to use for the root, and typically you want something unprivileged, right, for root. We wanted to sort of do root squashing like we do on NFS, but in SIFS. So here's a way to do it. You could add a nobody user, right? And presuming that nobody maps to that nobody on the server, you can add that into a key tab, set up the mount in etcfs tab, and then you mount the thing up, and then is knit is whatever user you want to, and then you should be able to just get in there. So the idea is that some notes about this, right? You really want to squash root access typically. You don't really want anything, you don't want to mount root. A lot of times people think, well, I should mount root as administrator, and that's usually generally not a good idea, right? we don't want to do that usually. But so the user can be really limited for root, assuming you don't really want root to go in there doing a lot of stuff. But he does need access to fetch attributes of the root of the share and any intermediate directories down to the root of the mount. That's somewhat of a bug. I mean, we need to go and fix. Right now, we used to be able to mount, and then you could mount a subdirectory of a share. That even if you didn't have intermediate permissions to some of the intermediate points, but now you actually do need to have permissions due to some changes that went in. So we need to fix that at some point. In any case, when you access like this, an unauthenticated user will get back at e-access on most six calls. So questions? Anyone?
Talk.
That's fine. That's fine. Yeah.
Yes.
So one thing I'm curious about is that since you get to play in both worlds, NFS and SIFS, the majority of users still use NFS v3.
Mm-hmm.
Do we see cases where NFS v3 does something much better than SIFS with the Unix extensions on?
Not really. Not generally. No, they're pretty on par, I think, feature-wise and performance-wise nowadays. So.
I mean, I think DFS and some of the caching features are better on the SIFS side, but there's other little things that I was worried about. The other thing is, performance. The NFS client has been doing great work on performance, some really good work on performance the last 2 years. Have you done a whole lot of checking versus the kernel server? NFS kernel server versus Samba?
No, I'm not. Well, I did some a while back, but it's been a while. I don't remember what the numbers were, but they're pretty. It's roughly similar.
That was the impression I got, that SIFS used to have an edge in the write path, but then NFS got better.
Mm-hmm.
And NFS had always been faster at reads, and now we're close to on par. So I don't think there's that huge performance difference. But I was wondering if you had seen things to the kernel server that were different.
No, I haven't. Bruce has been doing a lot of work to try to scale up the kernel server performance. Bruce Fields is the maintainer of the NFS kernel server, or Linux NFS kernel server, and so he's been doing a lot of work though to scale up performance and some other behavior of that server too. So I think it wouldn't surprise me if they were, most cases I think they run pretty close. Performance-wise, it's just that whoever happens to have done the latest optimization, right? So.